Chapter 7. Day 1. Charlie, Kirkman Specialty Clinic. Four of us left the office and walked down the road to the local Publix supermarket. Two of them were new to the practice, but thankfully, Janice joined our group. She and I were about the same age and had spoken at length a few times over the past year. She was sweet and as southern as you could get. She was from Alabama. As expected, the store was just as dark as all the other buildings we had passed. We went up to the sliding electronic front doors that had been manually pushed aside. A young man held up his hand to prevent us from entering. A crowd of customers sat in the parking lot, grimly checking their phones and sitting on the hoods of their cars.
"Sorry, closed," he said in a terse voice. "Electricity's out and we can't let anyone in."
"We're from Dr. Kramer's office," I said. "Are you Mr. Wainwright?"
"No," he replied. "He's in the back."
I looked back into the store, and I could see flashlight beams crisscrossing the aisles.
Well, at least they worked, I thought.
"Look," I said with a smile, "could you go get him? I would really appreciate it if you could do that for us."
"I'm sorry, but Mr. Wainwright's busy. We have to tape up the freezer doors and coolers so the food doesn't spoil. He can't break away now."
I continued to prod the young man, pleading with him to just reconsider. I tried to reason with him, beg him, and even flirt with him. Seeing that I'm a poor flirter, I didn't get far with that. Janice was standing behind me, listening to the conversation. She quietly turned around and unbuttoned her lab jacket. She fussed with something under her scrub top and quickly pulled out her bra. Her scrubs were tight to begin with, and once her bra was gone, her chest swelled out and made the top even tighter. Her cleavage was barely contained by the stiffened material. She stuffed her bra into her lab coat and slung the coat across her forearm. She did a little primping with her hair and eased into position next to my right shoulder.
"Oh, please," she said with a thick, honey-laced southern accent. "We have patients that are just suffering at our office. I know the doctor has check writing approval here."
"We brought a check. Or you could add it all up and send the bill with me. Then we could just go back and help those poor souls." She gently bit her lower lip when she finished and gave him a kitten-like smile. That was so over the top, I thought. He's going to have us escorted out of the parking lot. Until that moment, I never appreciated the power that an unleashed pair of breasts had over a young, heterosexual man. The poor kid never had a chance. He never raised his eyes above her neck.
Sure, he stammered. I'll go check.
He spun around and entered the darkened building.
"Holy crap," I said to Janice. "I never thought that would work."
"You'd be surprised," she said.
"More times than not."
"Well, you have more to work with than I do," I replied. "Honey," she said, as she worked her southern accent again, "it's not the size. It's the promise of what's past the fabric that holds their attention." We both laughed as Janice put her lab coat back on, covering herself once again. Within a minute, Mr. Wainwright came to the door. "Sir," I said, "Dr. Kramer asked me to speak to you directly. He gave me a list of things he needs at the office right away. He said you could help."
"Sure," he said in a hushed voice. "Go around back and I'll let you in. I can't have the others outside see that I'm making an exception for you. Just go around to the right and I'll meet you at the loading dock."
He left, and the poor, lust-struck boy returned to guard the door. Janice slid up next to him and gave him a kiss on the cheek, making sure to press her chest lightly against his.
"You are the sweetest thing," she cooed.
As we started walking down the sidewalk and around the building, she looked over at me, smiled, and said, "You never know when I might need him again."
"So why is Mr. Wainwright so accommodating?" I asked.
"Dr. Kramer saved his dad," Janice said simply. "He did a coronary CT scan based on some obscure symptoms and found an aortic aneurysm.
His dad had emergency surgery that day. If Dr. Kramer hadn't found the ballooning blood vessel, it would have ruptured, and Mr. Wainwright's father would have died instantly. I don't think any other cardiologist could have put those symptoms together and ordered that scan.
That's why I like the man, I replied.
Everyone just nodded their heads as we rounded the corner and saw the open door. Mr. Wainwright turned out to be the store manager. He led us into the darkened store and looked at the list the doctor had made. Most of the items were canned and dried food. He also had a shop for over-the-counter medical supplies like Band-Aids, Advil, and Tylenol, as well as a lot of feminine products. I wasn't sure why those were important. We filled up 4 carts to the brim and rolled them to the loading dock. Mr. Wainwright estimated the cost of the haul, and Janice filled out a signed blank check. He gave us a written receipt, and we rolled our carts by the back of the building and out onto the highway. We managed to avoid the prying eyes of the people in the parking lot and made it back to the office without incident. There were a lot of raised eyebrows as we sauntered down the thoroughfare. It really felt strange to walk in the middle of the street pushing a shopping cart, bypassing idled cars and trucks that should be traveling at over 40 miles per hour. We were unloading the items in the break room when Dr. Kramer came in to see if we had accomplished our mission.
"We're back, and Mr. Wainwright said to say hello," Janice said.
"Looks like you've gotten everything," he happily replied.
"Sure did," Janice shot back. "But I was wondering what these backpacks are for."
Dr. Kramer had us pick up any backpacks that were available. There were 3 black ones left in the school supplies section, and we grabbed them all. They were more book bags than backpacks, so we took them, given no other good options.
"They're for the future," he replied, without further explanation, and he left the room.
We all just stood and stared at each other, none of us knowing quite what he was talking about. The next few hours were mostly boring. A couple of people from the street made their way to the office, but Dr. Kramer told them to wait with their cars. We brought a hose out to the side of the building and provided water to any that wanted it. But by the evening, most had wandered off to wherever they could find shelter. A hotel down the street soon filled to capacity, while most folks started to walk home. By midnight, the street was mostly clear, and we settled down to get some sleep. Dr. Kramer had us wash out and fill as many containers with water as we could find. Trash bins and kitchen pots were sterilized and used to hold water. We kept them in one of the surgical suites. Every sink was sealed with plastic wrap and surgical tape, then filled to capacity. Dr. Kramer explained that the water pressure would likely give out as the theme parks and hotels nearby drained them. I settled down next to Janice on the floor of the reception area. Along with the waiting room, it was one of the few areas with carpet. The rest of the building was covered with surgical tile to enhance sterility in those areas. I fell asleep sometime after 2 a.m., awakening several times as people about me snored or shifted to find a comfortable position. I live by myself, and other than an occasional overnight guest, I slept alone. All those bodies moving about prevented any significant rest.
Chapter 8. Day 1. Officer John Drosky, East Orlando. It was dark by the time John got back to his patrol car, just a block down the road. The past couple of hours had been a mixture of hope and frustration. John watched strangers perform noble and kind deeds for each other under extraordinary circumstances. Others, gratefully a minority, seemed to descend into a primal need to lash out at others, taking or bullying anyone to get what they wanted. With the power out, the gas station and 7-Eleven on the block had closed. With no electricity to power the pumps, run the register or credit card reader, it was best for them to simply close up shop. But the owners or workers were stuck there. Most just sat in the door to their stores, letting the outside air keep them cool on a warm November day. In one instance,
two men tried to force themselves into a local gas-and-go convenience store. The two lowlifes had pulled out an old revolver on the owner, who was sitting in the doorway of the store, but didn't realize that his son was standing behind him with a Mossberg 500 shotgun. Although no shots were fired, John recognized the rapid societal deterioration that was taking place. It was easy to be charitable when you thought the power would be back on in a few hours. It was a different matter to give when you weren't going to be able to replenish what little you had left. It was going to get nasty soon. John's OPD uniform was a magnet for each and every person that he came across. Hundreds of people surrounded him with questions about the loss of power and demands that he do something about it, like he could actually turn the power back on. It reinforced his belief that people were totally dependent on the government, and society was only 3 days without power away from total anarchy. If the first few hours were any indication, fighting insurgents in Fallujah might actually look good compared to what he could expect in Orlando a week from now. John had been in the Marines before entering the police academy. He had used the Delayed Entry Program, DEP, when he turned 18 during his senior year at Colonial High School, becoming a poolee until basic training was completed the following summer. His 4-year enlistment contract ended while he was deployed in Afghanistan. His time in the 3rd out of Hawaii included 2 months of intense door-to-door fighting in Fallujah, where he lost several close friends to IEDs and sniper fire. The rest of the Anbar province proved almost as difficult, but he performed well, earning a number of ribbons and medals, including the Bronze Star with Valor and Purple Heart. That was 2004, just a year after he had been sworn into the Corps. At the end of his 4-year term of enlistment, he decided to enter civilian life and found his calling in with the Orlando Police Department. The training to become an officer took almost 5 months of full-time study at the local community college. With his military service record and top-of-the-class grades, he was quickly hired by the city. Although many days brought some frustrations, most of the time, John felt like he was making a difference. Most people were grateful for his work, and it was not uncommon for strangers to come up and shake his hand and thank him for being a cop. However, in a few days, his uniform was going to become a magnet for frustration and anger, as people realized that the government had failed to protect them at the most basic level. Without food, water, or power, citizens were going to become a lynch mob, and as unfair as that seemed, John knew he would be at the end of that rope. Yep, he thought, I need to get rid of this uniform. John decided that his best move was to hunker down in the young man's house for the night to see how things fleshed out. The walk to headquarters would only take him a few hours. But to what end? If airliners were falling out of the sky, there was no doubt that this was at least a regional event and probably not limited to the Orlando area. If electricity from other parts of the country could be diverted to Florida, he might see a restoration of the city's power within a few days. His apartment was at the other end of the city, and if he needed to, John felt he could make it there in a day's walk. Right now, he needed to rest and regroup. It had been a hell of a day. John re-entered the house. The bodies in the back bedroom needed to be left undisturbed in case forensics found their way here. It would be another day before they started to smell, and he doubted he would be here that long. John shut the bedroom door, entombing the two women if or until someone came to collect evidence. Either way, it wasn't his problem anymore. He went back to his patrol car and stripped it of anything of value. He collected his standard-issue Remington 870P shotgun and extra ammunition for both the shotgun and his 9mm SIG. A level 3A bullet-resistant tactical vest with OPD stenciled across the front came along. The first aid and toolkit, flashlight and batteries, along with a handheld radio, were also scavenged. Lastly, his personal backpack with a change of clothing and some workout wear for the gym were all taken into the house.
John searched about in the drawers and located some candles and several lighters. Soon, he had the kitchen lit up, and he began to create a bug-out bag out of his 5'11 backpack. One of the benefits of being active duty law enforcement was the discounts from tactical supply stores. His backpack, normally costing over $150, came with a 40% discount. With 8 years under his belt, he was close to making almost $70,000 a year. When he first started with the OPD and was earning just over $30,000, the discount meant so much more. John divided the food into two groups, those that would spoil without power, and those items that would last a while. Having separated the food into two groups, he further divided the long-term food into two more sets, high-calorie, lightweight, HCLW, items, and the rest. The HCLW items were set aside for his backpack. They included the standard items like peanut butter, candy, 7 protein bars, 12 instant oatmeal packs, and a half a jar of Planters peanuts, among other items. Everything that could be transferred into a Ziploc bag was moved into plastic and sealed. Jars or other breakable items in cans were abandoned. His only allowance for a jar was the peanut butter. He limited his metal containers to 2 cans of Spam, 3 cans of tuna, and a bunch of Underwood deviled ham spread, a nice find with 360 calories per can. Half of the calories were carbs, while the other half were fat and protein. He opened the refrigerator and quickly removed the few items he found. He was surprised at the lack of food for what should have been 3 people, but found a half a pound of bologna, half a loaf of bread, and some cheese and mustard. He managed to make 5 sandwiches and bagged them before putting them in the freezer, most of its space taken up by a couple of bottles of vodka. He pulled them out and consolidated them into 1 bottle before replacing the alcohol back into the freezer. It would, at least, act as a temperature reservoir to keep the sandwiches cold for as long as possible. When he was finally finished, and if he was careful, he figured he had about a week's worth of calories in his backpack. With that task completed, John decided to load up on calories from the food that would spoil over the next day or two. Cereal and milk, a Tupperware container of some kind of stew, not bad actually, and ice cream made up his late-night dinner. One of the things he had learned was that if you weren't going to be able to eat in the future, best to load up on the calories while you could. By the time Officer Drosky had finished, he felt like he was going to puke. He made his way into the bathroom, and grateful that the water still flowed and should be relatively clean, he stripped off his uniform and took a long shower. He scrubbed and shampooed and luxuriated in the hot, steamy water until he felt the temperature rapidly turn cold. With a sigh, he shut the water off, not knowing when a hot shower would ever come his way again. Having enjoyed the shower, he dried off and remembered to add some bleach for water purification and dish soap to his bag. Small containers in the garage were cleaned out, and 2 of them were filled with the disinfecting liquids. He had to plan for the long term, although where that would be was yet to be seen. John found the couch, and blowing out all the candles save 1, he got a pillow from one of the other bedrooms, along with a bed throw and spare sheets. He put his SIG 226 on the coffee table next to him and lay back, reflecting on the day and what the future held. His lack of a committed relationship, originally a sad side effect of his job, now seemed to be a benefit. Every year he would find or be introduced to a nice girl. At first, things would go well, but after a few months, the job would get in the way. His first few years were often night shifts and weekends. Not the best hours to foster a relationship with women working 9 to 5. However, the past year found him with more and more day hours and weekdays, a benefit of his increasing seniority. Now, just past 30 years old, John felt that the timing was right for a committed relationship. Unfortunately, finding the right match had gotten more and more difficult. Most of the single women were single for a reason. Not that John minded a hard-working woman, but the many dates he had been on over the past few years had not gone too well. Recently, the women he had dated were usually pushing 30 as well, and tended to be married to their jobs. John wanted a more old-fashioned marriage, one where he would be working while his wife could stay home, hopefully putting her energy into a family and not punching a time card or working late for a bonus check. It was starting to worry him that the women he was now meeting were not interested in children, but rather in their careers. On top of that, many of the women he had dated more than once turned out to want the thrill of dating a cop rather than wanting to find a committed relationship. John's Polish heritage had given him the tall, Slavic look that a lot of women found attractive. His blue eyes and swarthy dark hair looked especially good when he had not shaved for a day or two. So as nice as it was, sex wasn't a problem. Unfortunately, John wanted more than that, but had found that most of the good ones had already begun their lives with someone other than him. He was worried that he may have missed his chance between his 4 years as a Marine and the next 6 to 8 years of OPD, putting him on the street all those nights and weekends. Now, as he lay in the candlelit living room, he was grateful he didn't have anyone to worry about. His parents were dead, both passing within the last 4 years. He had been an oops baby, coming when his parents had given up hope of having a child. His mother was over 40 when he was born, and his father pushing 50. When his mom died of ovarian cancer 4 years ago, his father lost his will to stick around and passed soon after. John devoted himself to his work after that. It was all he had. Now, it seemed to be a blessing. As he drifted off to sleep, he heard a distant crack of gunfire. Knowing that it was many blocks away, he was grateful that he didn't have anyone to worry about. It made falling asleep a little easier, and he blew out the candle. A surprisingly deep and rested sleep found him a minute later, while the rest of the city began a slow burn towards its eventual demise. Chapter 9. Day 1. Holding Cell, 33rd Street Jail. The young man dozed in a fitful slumber while leaning against the wall of the holding cell. His new burn marks were starting to become both painful and exhausting at the same time. His skin had been scorched many times in the past 3 years, and like most painful or stressful things, a person's tolerance became almost non-existent with each successive assault. He didn't want to have to tolerate the pain anymore. It was what made him snap that morning, and it was keeping him from finding any comfort at the moment. He could hear the other prisoners murmuring amongst themselves, but he tried his best to look within himself and ignore the others. The smell of body odor from his fellow inmates and urine near the open toilet made for an interesting aroma. The aura of the others nearby left him wanting to leave, a feeling he hadn't felt since the whole ordeal began. Sticking the knife into his mother's girlfriend hadn't fazed him in the least. She was a monster, and monsters deserved to die. His mother, on the other hand, now that was starting to become a gnawing headache in the back of his brain. In truth, the death of his mother had been coming for years. She had become increasingly bitter as the years with her girlfriend passed. Several times in the first few years after the divorce, she had attempted to resolve things with his dad, but each time his father had rejected her attempts at reconciliation. The first time was when she lost her permanent alimony. The girlfriend's attorney had assured her that she would be set for life since permanent alimony would never end unless she remarried. It was all his mother needed to file for divorce and live the exciting life her girlfriend promised. She would never have to marry again. And what woman receiving permanent alimony would ever remarry when she could just live with their boyfriend or girlfriend and enjoy a lifetime of welfare? But when the final divorce decree came down, his mother only was given temporary rehabilitative alimony. She immediately tried to reunite with his dad, but he recognized her true motivations and refused. The second time she tried to reconcile with his father was when her girlfriend had beaten her. Again, his dad denied her, figuring she had made her bed, now she could sleep in it. His mom eventually agreed to go back to her girlfriend if she promised not to beat her anymore. That was when the boys started to become the punching bag, taking his mother's place. That was 3 years and 7 broken ribs ago. So the boy was conflicted when he thought of shoving the knife into his mother's chest. No matter what she had allowed and participated in, she was still his mother. It was hurtful that she let him be beaten, bruised, and burnt. So when she herself had crossed the line that morning and started choking the young man, she received the 6-inch blade for her efforts. But despite her abuse, it was still his mother. His OCD was starting to kick in, and the snakes and spiders that felt like they were crawling on his skin were starting to make their presence known. So he began to count the tiles on the ceiling to occupy his time and take his mind off his building stress. Soon, his skin settled down, and he started to feel the tightness in his chest abate.
"Hey, boy," he heard. "What you in for?" one of the others asked.
The young man barely heard the question, continuing his ritualistic ceiling tile counting, not wanting to have to start over if he lost his concentration. The others continued their murmuring, and then it got quiet. The boy had just finished counting the 3rd row of tiles when he felt a jolt to his left shoulder. Someone had hit him and one of the burn marks, and he let out a yelp. Standing in front of him was a tall, lanky man who desperately needed a shave and shower. His teeth, the few he had left, were covered in a plaque of yellow and brown crust that seemed to be holding them together, each of his lower front teeth tilting at an impossible angle. The man didn't look much past 40 years old, but his skin and teeth told a story of a very hard life. The tattoos on his upper body bled out of the neckline of his t-shirt, hinting of a well-inked torso beneath. His head had been shaved bald. If he had been a woman, he would have been described as ridden hard and put away wet. As it was, he didn't like the kid ignoring him, and the punch to his shoulder brought the boy back to reality. The man looked back at the others, searching for approval. He turned his attention back to the boy and glared at the youth, sizing him up like a lion would do to a gazelle.
"I said," he hissed, "what are you doing in here?"
The boy, well beyond caring, simply shrugged and continued to rub the burn that had just been punched.
"Are you stupid?" the man continued. "What are you doing in here?"
The boy stared at his tormentor, watching as the man constantly glanced back over his shoulder at the others. That's when he noticed the other man. Also shaved bald, this one had an air about him that reeked of authority. This one stared back at him, his eyes boring through the boy's gaze, leaving no doubt who is in charge.
"Come on, punk,"
the man in front of him said, as he clenched his fist for another strike.
"We want to know what a white-bred kid like you is doing in the cell with us. Now talk. What are you charged with?"
The young man relented. He looked down at the floor and whispered to the man.
"Murder," he said in a low voice.
"Murder my ass," the man chortled. "You ain't murdered no one."
The boy continued to stare at the floor as the man stood his ground in front of him.
"Okay, white bread," he continued. "Who'd you put down? Just who did you off? Your teacher? Was she giving you bad grades? Come on, tell me. Just who did you kill, Mr. Big Bad Man?"
"My mom," he whispered back.
The verbal assault ended. His assailant stepped back and turned to the others. The leader,
A big man, with even more tattoos than the first one, stepped forward. He moved with a grace that belied his size. As he approached, the boy could make out the tattoos with even greater detail. Several swastikas were evident, as well as an iron cross. The number 88 was stenciled on his right cheek, while the number 14 was stenciled on the left one. His blue eyes bore into the young man as he stepped up. He crouched in front of the boy and reached out, lifting his chin to stare into his eyes. The man, the leader of the group, spoke.
"Why?"
The boy, unsure why he should answer, simply lifted his shirt, and the man and his minion stared at his scarred and burned chest. The leader shook his head up and down, and letting go of the boy's chin, lifted his own shirt up, revealing the pucker marks of his own burnt and scarred torso. The leader turned to the others and pronounced,
"He's one of ours now. Protect him."
Then he turned back to the boy. "Name's Taurus," he said. "You're now protected by the Aryan Brotherhood. You'll be safe." And with that, the lights went out. Chapter 10. Day 2. Charlie, Kirkman Specialty Clinic. About 6 a.m. the next morning, I had had enough of my tossing and turning. Most of the people still slumbered, and the morning sun had not yet risen. I got up and found Dr. Kramer in the break room, making a large pot of coffee in an old percolator. I saddled up next to him and found two clean mugs. I knew where most of the utensils were stored, given the multiple lunches I had brought on my frequent sales calls to the office. We both worked in silence as we reflected on the situation, and unsuccessfully sought a solution to our predicament. It's very calming preparing your morning cup of coffee, almost zen-like. We sat down at the table and enjoyed our cup of java. After a minute of welcome silence, he put his mug down and we began to speak.
"Do you have any other clothes?" he asked.
"I have my workout clothes in my back seat," I cautiously replied.
"Why?" "Do you have gym shoes as well?"
"Well, yeah, they're running shoes," I said. "I usually hit the gym on my way home. But why are you worried about that?"
"I think you'll need those shoes and your workout clothes. I think we can even scrounge up some scrubs for you."
"Whoa," I said. "I'm not staying here that long."
"You may not have a choice," he flatly replied. "I haven't heard a single siren or other emergency vehicle all night. Have you?"
"Come to think of it," I said back.
"No. No, I haven't."
"Then it's worse than a local problem. It has to be at least citywide or greater."
He got up and refilled his mug, adding a bit of sugar and powdered creamer before returning to the table.
"Charlie," he started, "let me tell you what's going to happen over the next few weeks."
I started to interrupt him, fully intent on setting him straight. I was not going to stay here that long. No way. No how. But before I could get a word in, he held up his hand to shush me. He was Dr. Kramer, so I shut up and listened.
"Charlie, the world as you know it is going to fall apart. And I don't mean fall apart like a hurricane or tornado hit us. I mean fall apart like the world is going to end."
I couldn't believe what he was saying. If it had been anyone but him, I would have left the table and never come back, writing him off as a quack. But his eyes and demeanor told me that he wasn't fooling around. He was dead serious. And I held his gaze and just kept quiet.
"Do you have any place to go that is safe? Before you answer that, I mean safely away from the city or other large crowds of people."
I thought of all my relatives and friends. I tried to think of someone that lived in a rural area, maybe on a farm or in the country. I came up blank.
"Not really, doctor," I replied.
My father lives in Maitland, and my mom is in Tampa. All my friends live downtown or in Baldwin Park.
Hmm, he said. We'll have to think on this a bit.
We heard a sound outside the door, and Janice shuffled in and joined us.
Can you spare some coffee? She asked.
You know you don't need to ask, he replied.
Janice poured herself a large mug of coffee, added a yellow pack of sweetener, and plopped next to me at the table. We waited for her to take a couple of sips before we started back into the conversation.
I want you both to understand what we're facing here, he began again. We are looking at months or possibly years without power.
Janice and I both looked at each other. What he was saying was unfathomable. How could he be so certain?
You both know I was in the Air Force, right?
We nodded our heads in unison.
I have some experience with this scenario. We were trained in the potential effects of an EMP attack. Now, I'm not saying there has been an attack on the United States, he continued, but regardless of the cause, the results are the same. If what I remember is correct, it may take months or years to reestablish electric power and normal utilities. Large population centers like Orlando are not going to fare well. When people run out of food and water, they will go searching, and with no police, it's going to get ugly.
I shuddered at his words and hesitated to ask the next obvious question, but Janice beat me to it.
How bad is it going to get? She asked.
As bad as you can imagine, he replied, and worse. We sat silently for a minute. Neither Janice nor I could comprehend what he was saying.
Janice, he continued, do you have any friends or relatives that live outside Orlando?
Preferably in a rural or farm setting.
Well, she replied, my sister lives in DeLand. It's not really farm country, but she and her husband have a home on about 5 acres of land out east of the town. It's pretty isolated.
Good, he exclaimed. Then you need to get there when the time comes.
How will we get there? She asked. My car doesn't work, and there's no buses running to DeLand. Heck, there isn't anything running at all.
You're going to have to walk, he simply stated. Unless you have a bike, then you can ride there.
You're kidding, she said. You're pulling my leg.
I wish I was, he replied. In fact, I want you to be able to leave on a moment's notice. That's why I had you pick up some backpacks yesterday. You'll need them.
This is just ridiculous, she shot back. There is no way I can walk 35 miles to my sister's house. It would take days.
Possibly, he replied. But if I'm right, you won't have much of a choice.
I don't know, I interjected. I run at least 5 miles a day. If you walked at a good pace, you could be there in just over 24 hours.
That brings up my next suggestion, he said. Do you think you could take Charlie with you? It would be best if you traveled as a pair.
I don't want to leave here, Janice finally confessed. We have electricity and food. Why should I leave?
Because, he stated, it's going to get violent soon, very violent. People will turn on each other when they have nothing to eat. Most of the stores in the area only carry a 2 or 3 day supply of food. When people realize that the government isn't coming to the rescue, they will do what they must to feed themselves and their families. Once the stores are cleared out, there will be rioting and a lot of violence. Worst of all, criminals will realize that the police won't be around. There's nothing stopping them from committing any crime they want, no matter how atrocious or vile. You don't want to be here when that happens.
What are you going to do? I asked.
I don't have any choice, he replied. I have to stay here. I have almost a dozen patients that need to be taken care of. If I leave, they have no chance.
But if what you're saying is true, I countered, if you stay, you will die.
Possibly, he simply stated. But I can't leave them here alone. It's not who I am. I will stay until we are rescued or I'm no longer needed.
The implication that he would stay until the patience had expired shook me to the bone. What kind of man would stay and risk his life on such a hopeless cause? He would, I thought, as I stared back at this amazing man. Right then, I decided to stay as long as I could help. Looking over at Janice, I saw the same determined look in her eyes, too. "I'm staying," I said, "and I think Janice is with me on this as well."
"Ditto here," she replied. "I'm single, too. My sister is the only one in the area."
Dr. Kramer tried to argue with us, but we simply excused ourselves from the table and went out to the reception area, where our guests had begun to rise. We helped many to their feet, most of the patients being elderly, and a couple of them rather weak. I counted 11 patients and 7 staff members, including Janice and me. I went back to my car and retrieved my gym bag. I brought it back into the office and got out of my business suit. I changed into a borrowed set of scrubs and put on my running shoes. I felt a lot better getting out of my heels and into something comfortable. It helped my attitude greatly just having something comfy on my feet. Dr. Kramer brought a fresh pot of coffee and a pitcher of water, along with some breakfast items we had purchased the day before. After feeding our patients and arranging for their bathroom needs, he cornered the two of us.
"I know I can't make you leave," he said, "but I need you to plan on leaving quickly when the time arises. I need you to bring a backpack for each of you and meet me in my office in 15 minutes.
He turned and beat a path down the hall before we could ask any questions. 15 minutes later, we entered his office and found him in a new set of scrubs with freshly washed hair.
"I have a shower in my private bathroom," he stated.
"I want you to set up a schedule for the patients and staff to use the shower until the water shuts down. It won't matter how much we use now. We're a drop in the bucket compared to the hotels nearby. Please do that after we finish our conversation." He grabbed our backpacks and we went into the break room. He opened our backpacks and began to fill it with bottled water and some of the food we got the day before.
"I want you to keep these packs in my office closet. After we fill them with food and water, I want you to get a spare set of scrubs and add them to the pack. I also want to set up a small medical pack."
He put 6 water bottles on the bottom of the pack and began to stuff dried food into it as well. He left out the canned goods to reduce the pack's weight.
"I figure you will each need a minimum of 2,500 calories a day if you're walking and carrying some weight. I've loaded enough dried fruits, nuts, and power bars for 4 days in each pack. There are a few pouches of Gatorade in there as well. Now let's see about making up a small med kit. Also, if you need it, grab any feminine product and a roll of toilet paper."
We raided the office's supply cabinet, as well as some of the OTC purchases from the day before. Needless to say, after combining medications into 1 or 2 bottles, we had quite a pharmacy stuffed into a side pouch of the backpacks. Tylenol, Advil, and antibiotic ointments for cuts and scrapes. Gauze and other first aid items were encased in a Ziploc bag as well. We added a cheap flashlight we had picked up at Publix, and some baby wipes we had also bought. The grocery list was starting to make more sense. Dr. Kramer left us, so we took the opportunity to find another set of scrubs that we could take as well. When he returned, he handed each of us 2 bottles. One was a sample bottle of Valium, the other a similar bottle of hydrocodone. Both contained 5 pills.
"What do we need these for?" I asked. "This is so illegal."
"I don't expect you will need them for yourselves, but you might find them useful if the need arises."
"What kind of need?" I asked, not understanding such a cryptic statement.
"For trade," he simply replied. "They might just save your life." Janice and I looked at each other with an even deeper sense of fear. If Dr. Kramer was willing to risk his license and possible jail time to give us these drugs, it was serious. Dr. Kramer saw our expressions and gripped us both by our shoulders.
Sorry for the bad pun I'm about to use, the cardiologist said. But I'm as serious as a heart attack. You might need them in exchange for your freedom or even your life. I didn't know what to say. I was in shock. At least I thought I was, until he asked one more question. Do either of you have a gun? Holy Mother of God.
Chapter 11, Day 2, 33rd Street Jail.
Guard! Taurus bellowed. The corrections officer ignored the screams coming from the holding cell. All hell had broken loose when the power went out the prior night. Emergency lighting from the exit signs had provided some help for the first hour and a half, but those eventually died. With the air conditioning down, the jail became a giant sauna. Air failed to move, and the body heat of over 4,000 inmates sat stagnant within its walls. The oxygen in the building felt like it was being sucked away, making the guards and their charges even more uncomfortable. By morning, 12 of the inmates had passed out due to heat exhaustion. Michael James Jones had become a corrections officer after high school. He was entering his third year with the Orange County Department of Corrections, and until last night, had mostly enjoyed his job. Despite his youth, he was just 21 years old, he engendered a lot of respect from the prisoners. At almost 6.5 feet tall, he towered over all but a rare few of the inmates, and combined with heavy weightlifting, he presented a terrifying sight. He ignored Taurus's screams and turned to an approaching colleague.
"Hey, Mikey," one of the guards called out. "The warden's calling everyone into the cafeteria. Who's going to keep an eye on these guys?" "Captain says not to worry about it. Says we're going to meet and figure out what to do with them all," the guard replied. Jones shook his head and began to follow his coworker. As he strode down the hall, the prisoners became even more enraged. The only light in the hallway was coming from the officer's flashlight. He had already changed the batteries once, using his personal pen light, to put 3 new D batteries into the Maglite flashlight. He used up the remainder of the battery's life the night before, using the high beam setting to give the prisoners in his section as much light as possible. Now, he had the flashlight on economy mode. The 3D battery flashlight should last over 100 hours on this setting, but the light it generated was a fraction of the high beam.
"Man, the power's been out for hours. What time is it? My phone died yesterday," Jones said.
"Mine too," his friend replied.
"That's what the captain wants to talk about. It's spooky. Everyone's phones are dead. Doesn't make sense."
Some of the holding cells were small rooms with a solid steel door and shatterproof glass. Those had housed some of the more violent criminals. Late last night, they had been transferred into the common holding cells that had open bars which allowed airflow. Already, there had been several fights that had sent 3 inmates to the infirmary. They would live, but all had multiple fractures. Leaving the prisoners packed into the cells didn't sit right with Jones.
But with the power having been off
for over 12 hours, nothing was sitting right with him at this point. They made their way through various corridors and through locked doors that were now being manned with guards with keys, rather than the electronic-controlled locks. Each door had 3 corrections officers. All 3 carried live ammunition in their 9mm Smith & Wesson handguns, as well as 1 officer carrying a Remington 870 pump-action shotgun. Emergency lanterns sat on the floor, and weapon-mounted flashlights searched the hallway behind Jones for anyone who might not belong there. It was old-school security now. The 2 corrections officers made their way to the cafeteria and found a bench to sit on. Before they could finish greeting their fellow officers, the captain stepped on top of a table and began his speech.
"Gentlemen and ladies," he began, "this is no ordinary power outage."
And from there,
It only got worse. Jones learned of the total loss of all electronics. Several officers had made their way outside and witnessed the shutdown of the city. Reports of aircraft falling from the sky and the lack of response by emergency personnel anywhere reinforced the magnitude of the crisis. Our problem now is that we are losing our ability to keep the prisoners in their cells. Besides the obvious lack of air conditioning, the muffin monster is not functioning, and we have sewage backups on the first floor.
What's the muffin monster? Jones whispered.
It's the sewage grinder, one of the other officers whispered back. When they send the piss and shit into the sewer system, it goes through a sewage grinder before it's put into the city pipes. If the electricity stops, a backup generator kicks in. If that doesn't work, the crap backs up and comes back out the toilets and drains. The captain continued to drone on and on, but the few salient points Jones picked up were simple and frightening. First, the power may not come back on for a long time, possibly weeks or months. Second, the prisoners were going to have to be let out of their cells and held outside the jail, but inside the double fence that surrounds the building. The captain didn't get into the details of the transfer, other than to say that all guards were to stay on duty until relief arrived. When that was, nobody knew. Jones did some mental calculations as he made his way back to the post. It was already closing in on breakfast and getting light outside, but no one had mentioned feeding the guards, let alone the prisoners. How 4,000 criminals were to be guarded by a few hundred guards was beyond his pay grade. It didn't seem possible, but that was the brass's problem, not his. My problem, Jones thought, is to stay alive, and maybe find something to eat. Captain Braddock stepped down from the table and strode back to the administrative side of the building. Two of the judges, Judges Bender and Hernandez, had been stuck in the jail since yesterday afternoon. Both had been in the middle of arraignment hearings when the power died, and both sat with open shirts and no shoes, trying to stay as cool as possible in the stifling heat. I don't see that we have a lot of choices here, Bender said to the room. If this goes on for more than a few days, we'll have to let as many of the non-violent prisoners go as we can. I think we're jumping the gun a bit, Judge Hernandez replied. I wish we were, Captain Braddock retorted. We've been through this already. There are no emergency protocols for this type of situation. We've most likely been hit with an